Okay, so we had quite a lot of material last time. I hope that we also managed to cover a bit today. But especially the end part was a bit rushed, so let's recall what we finished. We breezed through definitions of denotational semantics for arithmetical and Boolean expressions, and I gave already semantics to most commands. I'm not sure if you had a look at the slides again. I made some correction, especially this some corrections, especially this horrible notation that you saw last time. But roughly, if you recall, we agreed that the notation of commands should be in terms of partial functions from states to states. And we were thrown a bit of course or confused by what to do with the while loop business. So the obvious way of defining it seemed to have this recursive or co-recursive or circular flavor, where you use the definition inside, where you use the thing that you want to define inside its own definition. So we then start to think that maybe all of this stuff that we heard about fixed points can be useful again. And now maybe even in a setting where we deal with something totally infinite, because it was a bit of overkill to talk so much about fixed points in context of functions on finite power sets. Here, those kinds of theorems would be more non-trivial. And this is, I think, where I cut it off. I'm pretty sure that this part was already too quick last time for most people to notice. So I suggested that maybe we could instead define a function, again, function on this partial function space. So sometimes these kind of things are called higher order functions or functionals or functional forms, however you want to call it. So we have something which is taking a partial function from state to state and producing another partial function from state to state. And maybe if we could produce a fixed point of something like this, then this would be a good, so a fixed point of this thing should be element of this partial function space. And maybe one of those fixed points would be a good semantics for a while. And in general, it seems that this is the way to go when defining semantics of recursive functions. Is it clear what we are doing here? Or is it just jumble of notation? So this functional or higher order function that I'm trying to define now, parametric in both the, so we are trying to give the semantics of, recall again, while B do C and so this is our B and this is our C, but B is the Boolean expression, which is the guard of the while loop, and C is the command or sequence of commands that is the body of the loop. So now we are defining something parametric in these two guys. And given something which is command and partial function, some way of transforming states into other states. And given also some candidate for state, so this sigma comes from here. Right? This is where this F lives, and this is where this sigma lives. What this functional is supposed to do? We already have a concrete state now as an input as well. So if our Boolean guard, which is the guard of our while loop evaluates to bottom is false in this state, then the function produced by this function out of our original f should leave the state unchanged, meaning the while loop should not execute. Obviously so. Otherwise, we can make this f, which is presumably behaving like this execution of the the f itself is like the not body of the loop itself, but maybe all the possible finite iterations of the body of the loop. Well, we see about it. This is just an argument which we are going to construct a fixed point. So otherwise, this f should be able to do one more step using the using what our command C, the body of the loop, is supposed to given starting from a given C. And then if you find a fixed point or something like this, this should behave like our recursive while loop. Was this explanation or this intuitively slightly enlightening or not quite? What is going on here? Well, of course, in fact, even after I'm going to prove that this thing can be given a fixed point, a very concrete fixed point, these fixed points, this would not be good enough to convince you that I'm doing the right job. Only after, actually, after we return to axiomatic semantics, and I'm going to introduce the Hoare rule for while loops, and then prove that it behaves against this with this specific semantics, we get the right partial correctness assertion and the right weakest precondition. I'm throwing those terms, but we are going to see precisely what they mean soon. Only then we will hopefully get this enlightenment and see that this funny functional is precisely or the fixed point of this funny functional, and this concrete fixed point that we are going to choose is giving the right semantics of while loop. So another way, of course, would be to have some operational semantics, like abstract machine, specifying exactly how you execute the programs, and then to show that also the obvious or automatic or standard way of transferring this axiomatic semantics into the notational semantics agrees with the definition that we are going to obtain here. So the beauty of the notational semantics on the one hand is that you get clearly defined mathematical objects to play around with. The problem is sometimes that you have to deal with a situation like this, where at least at the first sight, unlike when I give you definition in the small step semantic size, where I just write abstract machine, it's not immediately clear what is supposed to happen here. But we will get there. And I hope that this is not such complex math anyway, what we are seeing here. Okay, so we want to find so we need to investigate the issue of the existence of fixed points on this underlying domain, so something much more complicated than finite power cells that we're talking about. We remember that monotone functions on complete lattices have fixed points from the Knaster-Tarski theorem. Is this something I could use here? So what do we need to show? That this thing is a complete lattice, and this funny functional or a function on this lattice and the function is monotone. Let's start with the second one. Does this look good enough? This might be so, but if I don't see enthusiastic agreement, we have to go through the proof on the blackboard. And how about this one? Well, let's go slowly. So first of all, let's agree that we know what the partial order is that I'm talking about here, because if I'm talking about lattice, I have to have some potential lattice, or maybe not lattice. I should have some concrete partial order in mind. And then the obvious way how you order partial functions is by inclusion order on their graphs. So we can think of partial functions as some special kind of relations, those that have this right uniqueness kind of property. So for if x is related to y and x is related to z, then y and z must be equal. And then if you have relations which are understood as a subset of the Cartesian power, you can simply contain them for compare them for inclusion. What that would mean specifically here? So first of all, the domain of one partial, the smaller partial function must be contained in the domain of the bigger partial function. And whenever the supposedly smaller partial function is defined on a given input, on a given state here, the larger one should be also defined on that input and produce the same value, right? That's the obvious way to compare partial functions, which would be trivial if you were trying to order total functions. If you look at this definition, you see immediately that the only thing that you would get out of this definition on total functions is what order? Total order? Is it total order? What's the word I'm looking for? This kind of ordering would produce what on total functions? So total functions are those ones which are defined for every input when this thing, where it's never the case that f of sigma is equal to non-termination or bottom constant. What does the, if you take the subdomain or subset of this space consisting of total functions, this partial order restricted to that subdomain or subspace would be what? Yes? Right, so it will be discrete order, right? The only thing f is comparable with is itself, if it's a total function. But for partial functions, this is non-trivial. Partial functions can be properly contained in each other, in this sense. Does this yield a poset? I mean, this definition? Is it obvious to see, or? So, because we are defining this relation using inclusion order, which is a poset, if we want to save our, I mean, it's of course rather straightforward to write an argument that this relation is reflexive, is transitive, and weakly antisymmetric too, but we could even save ourselves a bit more work. And if we want to be a bit more pompous, I use this word stability under relativization or stability under substructure when I was talking about poset, and any substructure or relativization of a poset is still a poset, right? So even the fact that this relation is defined using something which we know already to be a poset means that this relation restricted to the those relations that are partial functions is a poset again. So we have a poset. Good enough. That's a good starting point. Well, then the other thing that we probably better be able to show immediately is monotonicity of this thing. What does monotonicity mean? It means that whenever I give you a partial function f which is smaller or containing, or when you have g extending f, there are all sorts of words one can use here, then it should be the case that what this functional is doing with f is again refined or extended, but what the same functional is doing with g. Shall we write it or not? So I actually, in fact, when spelling out what this containment means on the previous slide, I could have saved myself saying the domain of F is being contained in the domain of G simply by using notation convention that we had about this non-termination constant, which would already imply that the second condition implies the first. So what we want to show is that if F of BC F is defined sigma, then is defined as well and equal to G. Right? This is what we need to show. Equal to not G, but this whole thing. So what is this? If we have to split cases, case one, our Boolean expression, the guard of the while loop in our sigma evaluates to bottom. By the way, notice that I replaced this horrible notation with double true, double F that Christoph said made him think that his glasses went completely wrong. He purchased me one with this nice blue version of ordinary logical symbols. I hope this doesn't confuse anyone. Then what happens is that actually, whether we have F or G here, our functional will produce the same thing, right? Which is just sigma. That's what the definition says. And the logic of assertions in our world is classical, Boolean, so it can only be either top or bottom. And when it's these are not assertions, these are Boolean expressions. We are still talking about semantics of the programming language itself rather than the metalanguage of assertions. So then the other situation that may happen is that our Boolean expression, the guard, happens to evaluate to top in the setting. And then if you look at what this thing is doing and at the slide, we get that F, B, C, F on sigma is equal to F on C on sigma, right? Clear enough. And now, I didn't write explicitly the assumption from the slide. I hope that you copied it in the notes. So what we are assuming, of course, is that f is itself is contained in G, or that G extends f or refines f or whatever, however you want to call it. So this means that, well, either this thing is undefined, and in this situation we don't care, right? So case 2a, then we don't care. Right? The only thing that we have to show is to analyze is what happens if when this guy is, which is equal to this, happens to be defined. Then by assumption, maybe we should give names to those assumptions. So this is assumption one. And this is the case, well, this is the case that we are in case two. So by assumption one, this guy is equal to what G is doing with the state produced by the denotation of command C when given the input state sigma. And what? How do we finish the proof now? So I got here, and now I know that the guard, I still know, I didn't forget yet, that the guard of our while loop evaluates to true in this state. So the semantic, so also phi bc on g of sigma has also had, also has to go down this route. It's sigma, right? Not delta. My sigmas and deltas are very easy to confuse. Clear? What happened here? So it's extremely trivial mathematically. There is nothing happening here practically, but maybe it pays off to press the brake pedal so that we have an opportunity to digest what exactly is happening the most basic level here. Okay, so we know that we have a monotone function and a poset. Is this good enough? So, am I missing something here? Is this a complete lattice? In fact, I could ask something much more brutal. Is this thing a lattice at all? Complete or not? What can go wrong here? So, let's say that we talk about extremely simplistic members of this space of partial functions. So I'm using here already the convention of identifying a partial function with its graph, a set of pairs. So I have, and remember that states themselves are also functions. So we have partial functions defined on functions, which I don't know. We don't go all the way down in the theoretical hierarchy. So we have these two partial functions. One which is taking the trivial, the state where all the variables are initialized to zero and is leaving it alone. And it has no clue what to do when there is any variable which is not initialized to zero but stores some different value. And another one which also only cares about the situation where all the variables are initialized to zero, but then it flips them to one. Right? Both of them, do we agree that both of these guys are valid members of this thing? We have two partial functions on the state space. Now, well, of course, these things are set theoretical entities. You could form a set theoretical sum, but you wouldn't obtain any more something which satisfies this right uniqueness, this partial functionality of the relation, because then you would have two pairs, both of them has, which have the same state as the first argument, but different values, different states as the second coordinate. And for this, the same reason, not only just the sum, set theoretical sum itself, but no other partial function. If you recall again the definition of the partial order that we had on them, can extend. So it's not even that they don't have lower super upper bound, they don't have any upper bound in this lattice at all. Is it clear? It's not trivial to find upper bounds or joins of partial functions. So the Knaster-Tarski theorem is useless in the original form. It really required that we had this complete lattice where you had all infima and all suprema. And remember that if you have all infima, then you also have all suprema. And if you have all suprema, then you also have all infima. But we can compute, in fact, least fixed points on a much bigger class of posets using a generalization, in fact, of the strategy that we already used when we were computing least fixed points for the purpose of model checking on finite power sets. You remember what we were doing, right? We were starting with the bottom element in that empty set, applying our function to it once, look if it's stabilized, if not once again. And if we were on the finite set, you couldn't go on forever like this, right? You kept growing and growing and growing, but at some point you had to hit a point where you don't grow anymore, which could be very well the, if you were on the lattice, so you always had on a finite lattice, so you always had an upper bound, in the worst case, you always hit the greatest element, one. But presumably you finish much earlier than that, as in all concrete examples, that, or not all. Most interesting concrete examples that we're seeing when computing fixed points in connection with model checking. We can play the same game here in a slightly more sophisticated way. The only little thing that we have to verify is a slightly stronger assumption than our functional. I already verified monotonicity, and it was mostly just to cool down because it was so nice and easy. In fact, I should have proved something more about it in order to ensure that this guy actually has a fixed point. So in order to think what conditions we are talking about, both on the poset itself and on the function on this poset, let us think in which cases this counterexample that I was showing you would break down. Right? So which sums of partial functions are okay then? We could find very trivial examples even with just partial functions with single element domain. Any suggestions, hints? You don't have to be exhaustive. It doesn't have to cover all possible cases, but any special subcase where you think you could actually take a set theoretical sum of two graphs, and you still obtain something which is a partial function. There are many such. Yes? Exactly. That's a very good idea. But also, yes, that was the first one. Good. You are really reading my thoughts, or you read my slides before. Also when the graphs of one is containing the other. That's another possibility. In this case, of course, set theoretical sum is completely trivial because it's just the larger of the two. But strictly speaking, we can do that as well. And of course, we could go on further with this analysis and notice that both of these two cases are borderline cases of a marginal situation where simply those partial functions agree on those parts of the domain, or this part of the domains where they overlap, right, on the intersection of the domains. And this is what matters. Actually, it might be that we don't have to return to this when talking about semantics of programs involving allocation and blah. It's useful then to talk about these kind of things. But for the time being, actually, most of the time, these two border cases are the only ones of interest. And you may wonder why on earth I'm mentioning even something so trivial as, but actually this is more interesting for us in this moment, the setup where, because when looking at this special case, you can also think of entire generalization of it. So assume that I'm not comparing just two, trying to form an upper bound of two partial functions, but a bound of whole infinite family of them, which is linearly ordered by this inclusion between the graphs. So every partial function in this family is specialized by another one, and any two are comparable. I can form a set theoretical sum then, yeah? And that's slightly more interesting than when you just form a set theoretical sum of two of them, because when you form a set theoretical sum, maybe bigger than each particular element of this, well, let's use the word, chain of this partial function, right? Is it clear? So we can now formally define what omega chain in a posset is, and it's just something like this. That's not a very nice way of defining things mathematically, so we can identify such a chain with a posset morphism. So functions which is monotone or other preserving from natural numbers. Actually, I think that monotone is the name we are going to use most often. From natural numbers with the standard ordering to this posset with whatever order we chose on it. In this case, of course, we have concrete posset in mind. And then we say that our posset is an omega CPO, omega complete partial order, if suprema of all omega chains exist, and by the way, so does the least element bottom in this omega CPO. Sometimes people want to distinguish between omega CPO, just omega CPOs and omega CPOs with bottom, so sometimes this notation is used, but we won't be so pedantic, we never have any need to make this special distinction. Also, when you talk about those guys, you probably also want to insist that your functions preserve bottom, and that would be horrible for us. Why? If the function on omega CPO with bottom preserves bottom, then you get the trivial smallest fixed point. So it's not what we're looking for, and of course we couldn't use this kind of restrict our attention to this kind of functions to give semantics to our programming language, really. So we just observe that we have an omega CPO. If I press you, of course, all of you will be able to write a mathematical proof for that. And in fact, we could even do better than this. It's not just if we care to generalize the notion of chain a bit, but we don't have any need for that. So now, again, let's repeat the question for this slightly improved setting. Is it true that every monotone function on an omega CPO has a fixed point? That's actually not a trivial question. Especially if you start thinking or raising your brain about most typical omega CPOs that you can think of, things that seem good enough candidates for omega CPOs. So you may now start to think, I don't know, real numbers, and then you think about sequences of things approximating integers or whatever, and then you try to make these steps incrementally smaller. But then you realize that real numbers are actually linearly ordered. And then you realize that you can also form a cofinal omega sequence consisting just of natural numbers, right? 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I don't have an upper bound for this. So maybe I need to add some one point in infinity. And if you're very pompous, you can give it a name, like, I don't know, Stone-Cher compactification, whatever. But you just add one infinity point at the very end. But then what are you going to do with this point, right? If you want to construct the counterexample, you have to send it to something. And because your function is monotone, this is something that we should make absolutely clear, then it looks like nothing can be higher. Our function cannot produce anything bigger than what you get out of this infinity point. So maybe now I need to add a hierarchy of such infinity points. And this is already starting to go in good direction, but it's also having dangerously set theoretical flavor, right? So let's not go too far there. For those of you who are interested in set theory, we can briefly discuss the obvious set theoretically counterexample to that. But if you have not heard about cardinal numbers, and I don't assume that you necessarily are familiar with this, then I don't have any better example right now at hand for this. Let's just record the fact that it's not immediately obvious why every monotone function on an omega CPO should have a fixed point. In fact, if you press strong enough, it won't. Although the counterexamples are quite hard to construct, let's agree. But then, just to finish our job, we need to propose a mild strengthening of the monotonicity thing. Namely, also restrict a bit the class of functions that you're looking at and talk about omega continuous ones, which are those which preserve suprema of those omega chains. And that's all we care about. We can, for the purpose of the theorem that I want to state, we don't even need to bother with the situation where this poset has some much larger suprema, which require a non-countable cardinality to approximate, and whether this function is preserving them or not. Let's just think about preserving suprema of chains. Right? Is it clear what this definition is saying? So, first of all, is it well posed definition? Because in an omega CPO, we can form suprema of omega chain. So here I have omega chain by assumption. Is this thing an omega chain? If I know that this thing is an omega chain, is this thing an omega chain? Come on, this is a trivial question. I'm saying this, right? So if I have this, is this omega chain? According to the definition. Why? Biggest? Why do I talk about biggest elements? I'm not talking yet about the suprema or joins or whatever. I'm just asking if this thing is linearly ordered chain, if this thing was. Well, I'm asking, so I'm saying that F is monotone. I know that W0 is below W1. Because the thing is, F is monotone, I'm stating this explicitly, then I have to have that f on w0 is below f on w1. W1 is below w2. Therefore, because f is monotone, I have to have that fw1 is below fw2, right? This is all I'm asking. So I get an omega chain here, and now I can form a supremum because I'm in an omega CPO. That's all that I wanted to say. But on the other hand, in fact, monotonicity does not need to be explicitly stated if you read this definition the right way. So it's always a bit iffy if you write a mathematical definition in form of equation, and this equation relates to things that are not necessarily well defined. But so if you read this equation as saying for any omega chain W0, W1, W2, the supremum of those Fs on omega, so the image of this chain via our function has a supremum. And moreover, this supremum is equal to what this function is doing with the supremum of the original chain. Why does this imply monotonicity? Again, argument is completely trivial. There is no mathematics of any sense whatsoever. It's just making as trivial use of this definition as possible. So stupid that it should be illegal. How can I put this definition to a very trivial use to ensure that whenever this is the case, then also this thing should be the case? If I know just this, I need to form some kind of omega chain, right? What omega chain would that be? I don't need to use too many elements to form this chain. For all I care in the world, only those two guys may exist. How would you form an omega chain out of them? I never said that this chain has to be properly increasing, right? I mean, many of you know probably what I'm heading and you just don't feel like speaking out, but we're losing time in this way and I don't want... So if you have an idea, don't worry if it's right or wrong, just say it and then we can work with it. And what would be the obvious way of putting this definition to use to show that any function omega continuous in this way have to be monotone? So this, if I have, assuming this, I can show that this holds. If I just know this. So I show you how to, I just explain how to, in this case, how to make sure that this thing in this omega chain using monotonicity. Now I don't assume monotonicity of F. I want to show it that if I assume omega continuity in this sense, I get monotonicity. Is there anything unclear of what I'm asking for? So you need to define some kind of omega chain, a function from natural numbers to our poset. How would you define it? Well, how about... Maybe I need to make some space. My W is becoming increasingly omega-like. This is my chain, right? I'm defining a function from natural numbers, which is W1, F of 0 is, or W on 0 is W1, and F or W on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is always W2. This is an omega chain, right? Because processes are always reflexive. What is the supremum of this chain? Come on. What is the supremum of this chain? Anybody? Yes? W2, precisely. So we know now that maybe it's confusing that I'm using W for chain, and because now I need to write. Okay, let's say that this is V1, V2, V3, V4, V5, or V, sorry, and all these things are equal to W2. So, supremum of these things is W2. And now we know also that supremum of this thing, which I'm not assuming to be the chain yet, right? I'm just saying that supremum of this thing has to exist. So we have a set of this form. Sorry, what am I saying? And this thing contains just those two elements, right? So what we are saying here is that F of W2 is the supremum of this set, meaning, in particular, because it's a member of this set itself, of course, it's its greatest element, greater than its other element, which is F of W1. So in a sense, it's a bit redundant to say monotone and omega continuous. You can already say, as long as you don't state already, assume somehow here that you are talking already about the chain, that you can then say that omega continuity implies monotonicity. Is it clear? So, okay, let's forget about it. So in a sense, I check something redundant here, because now we want to check that our functional is omega continuous. Oh, this is going much slower today than the last time. I'm on the 11th slide. Okay, maybe we finish. More close. 50 slides, I think. So then, of course, the reason why I was bringing up to it is because these two assumptions, that the underlying faucet is an omega CPO, and that the function that we have on it preserves suprema of countable chains, yields that we can obtain the least fixed point of such function. And moreover, we have a concrete description of this least fixed point. We obtain it as a supremum of a chain. Aha, is this a chain? Do we see this? So this thing is, this F is omega continuous, therefore it's monotone. And if this F is monotone, then we have that this holds because bottom is bottom, and it has to be below everything, including F of itself. Then if you apply F on both sides of this inequality using monotonicity, you get F square, and so on and so on. Again, we could turn it into proper inductive proof, of course, but it's a bit too tricky. So we get here an omega chain. Therefore, because we are in omega CPO, we can form its supremum, its join. And what I'm claiming now is that this chain is the least fixed one, that our F stabilize on the guide that you obtain by summing this thing. Actually, let's do the proof. So what we need to show are two things. Oh, Jesus, I just erased what I wrote. We need to show two things. One is that the supremum of the non-existing chain, of the race chain, is a fixed point, and that this is the least one. Right. So we need to show that the convention, of course, is that f0 on any x is just x itself, it's a linear chain, is equal to this. And as you look at it, you may see that there is not so much to show. Right. So, by omega continuity, which is, of course, very important here. Otherwise, we couldn't push this f through our supremum. And by the fact, well, maybe let's state what I just erased, that, no, let's not. It's obvious, right, that this thing is a chain. This looks eerily familiar, right, or really similar to what we have on the right-hand side of this equality. The only difference is that you start indexing. So instead, I could write here n with superscript 1, if I'm super hyper, double and triple pedantic. So rather than starting from 0, right? So I'm only taking those numbers that are successors of numbers, so I'm just excluding 0 in this supremum. But adding bottom, making a join with bottom, remember that I assume that we have bottom, of course, otherwise this whole thing will not work at all, is not changing anything. So bottom, and for any x we have that bottom supremum x is just x. This is clear, right? So we have this. It's clear that here we have 0. What's? Why do you look suspicious, Christoph? What have I done wrong? So, and this thing is obviously equal to this, right? Clear? So the only thing that we need to show to finish the proof is that this thing is not just any old fixed point, but the least of them. But this is actually very trivial. So you, what is the last step? This one or this one? Because here we're starting from 0, and f0 of bottom is just bottom. The problem is that this whole damn proof is so trivial that you almost don't see what is going on mathematically. But I wanted to spell each and every step because, you know, if you're doing a mathematical proof, and especially if you do it in a proof assistant, you have to know. But of course, this is stupid, right? The only thing that is happening here. when we're pushing f through this supremum using omega continuity. So this is just direct application of the assumption of omega continuity combined with the direct application of the obvious observation that f on iterated application of f on bottom for any monotone function form an omega chain. There is nothing else here. Clini theorem really does not require heavy mathematics to show. The only, so do I need to show now that this is the least fixed point? Or is it obvious? Because it might be that I'm wasting too much time. I do waste too much time today. But I would be very, very happy if you every now and then don't tell us the obvious stuff, which is only confusing us more in the end. So is it obvious that this thing is the least fixed point? Why? Can anybody give, like, maybe somebody else than Merlin, you know, I don't want to abuse him so heavily. So how would you show that this thing is the least fixed point? So assume that I have some other... okay, in the end I'm writing it anyway. So I assume, let's assume that I have whatever, W such that F is equal to W. Then, of course, bottom is below that W, right? And it doesn't matter in how what this W is. Well, actually, let's do proper mathematical induction. So we want to show by induction that for any n, Fn on bottom is below our W. Inductions unfunctional. So this is trivial, right? Nothing to show. Inductive step. So we assume that Fn bottom is below W by induction hypothesis. By monotonicity then, monotonicity, we get that f of n of bottom is below f of w, because this thing is a fixed point. We get that. So that was our assumption here. And this, of course, by definition is clear, right? So we have shown that this W is an upper bound of the whole chain, and the definition of this thing is least upper bound, the smallest of them. And that's all, right? Lots of completely, well, it wasn't completely trivial to find those conditions, to realize what it, to isolate the exact mathematical ingredients that this proof, makes this proof tick, and realize that they are important and what one can use them for. But the actual reasoning that is happening here, as you see, is basically the same size in order of your radio. It isn't like that for now. So the only thing we need to do to finish our proof that we can use a fixed point theorem, namely Clini fixed point theorem, to give the semantic of while by giving a function, giving a fixed point of this functional is function, is to by showing that this thing is omega continuous. And again, we could in fact show something stronger. The only thing that we need is that we form, that we have a chain of partial functions or by inclusion, doesn't matter whether it's countable, whether it's isomorphic to natural numbers or not. Okay, let's do it. Whatever, it's going to be almost the entire lecture today. So, assume we have omega chain of partial functions. F0, F1, F2. Forgive me for not writing the square containment, but square partial order, but just ordinary containment symbol, because we already know that in fact this is ordinary containment. And I want to show now that one thing that we are going to use here is the obvious, depends in which mathematical world you are living in, assumption of function extensionality. So those of you who have seen how it can work out in constructive mathematics and proof assistance know that this is not always completely allowed game to play, but it's extremely unusual to work in a mathematical setting where functions are not extensional. So we use function extensionality. We need to show, in other words, we just need to show function equality pointwise. And of course, set theory as foundation of mathematics gives us this, because you identify function with its graph and then the graphs are either equal or not. Show equality pointwise. So again, our question mark is whether this thing is equal to this. Again, because of the way our functional is defined, we need to, so here we have one single function, right? We already agreed that this thing, sum of a chain, because this is a chain, is a partial function itself. And then two things can happen, which are again completely independent of those f's. They only depend on this, the guard of our loop, the command, and our state sigma. So case one, the guard of our loop does not hold in this state. Well, then of course, both this thing and all those things are doing one and the same thing in this particular sigma for this particular thing. Then by definition, sigma how do you even write it? So it's this countable family of constant countable family of sets which only have sigma in it, right? So that's the first case. Case two. Something happens. The loop gets executed. Now what? Again, we need to split cases. So either all of those dudes are undefined on, maybe I should write it. And maybe then let's do the other case first. So let's assume that at least one of them, one of those F ends in the chain. Is defined on what our command C is doing with the state sigma. Is defined on then what? All the n plus k's for n and k are also defined on this guy and have to send the same value because we are talking about chain of partial functions. Right? So, this is also what we obtain then in the limit. maybe let's not use the same n, or maybe let's fix this n to be some n0. And this is what now it's different bracketing, right? So this is also what by definition of our functional the right hand side, the left hand side of this equation is supposed to be. Otherwise, well, this can be left now as an exercise. If none of them is defined, then the entire sum of the chain must be also undefined. If no Fn is defined on sigma, then is undefined as well. The rest of the proof finishes like this. So we get something which is omega continuous, and therefore the one omega CPO, and therefore Krini theorem applies to it. And this is the most straightforward way of computing fixed points conceivable. Right. So finally, we can now formally, right? And I'm already incorporating the specific way of computing fixed points that Krini theorem tells us I'm allowed to use here. The semantics of while B do C and while or and do is the sum of all finite iterations of this functional starting from the empty set. And you may already start to think what is happening here. So for n equal to 0, I will only obtain something that does, that is defined for those sigma where the guard is false. Then, of course, the loop terminates very, very quickly, leaving the state unchanged. Then we also have those states where one iteration is enough to make the guard false. Then you also have, you add them to the notation. Then you also have those states where you need two iterations to make the guard false. If you sum this up, you will obtain precisely the function that it terminates even only you can make the guard false infinitely many steps. And this is really what is happening here. So we turn our imp programs into mathematical objects at the expense of a lot of sweat, at least on my side. And it would be much harder, in fact, to be to do it for real-life languages, giving them rational semantics to most of, even quite restricted versions thereof, academic versions thereof, for anything that involves something more than just most basic variable iteration and this more straightforward form of storage or input output, we just store variables into locations or program variables. This can get quite messy, and it's often non-trivial mathematical problem to do it, but it's good enough for our purposes. So now we can return to Hoare triples because now we know what to evaluate our soundness and completeness claims against. So first of all, well, we still need to do some semantic clauses. We need to extend our semantics to extended arithmetical expressions, which were building blocks of Hoare assertions. And recall that the only difference with this extended arithmetical expressions was that they involved additional type of variables, which are log var, and therefore our semantics has to involve interpretations or interpretation functions of those integer variables or meta variables or logical variables into integers. But of course, these integers or meta variables or however you want to call them can be identified with functions sending those logical variables to a very, very special subclass of arithmetical expressions that we had in the language itself because we had a name for every integer. So it's just conceptual switch. Instead of thinking of this function as sending it to a real integer, whatever this thing is, we're sending it to the constant in the programming language that is naming this integer. Why am I playing this funny game? Well, then I can now inductively kind of extend this lifted interpretation functions to something which is interpreting the entire class of extended or Hoare arithmetical expressions into arithmetical expressions of the object language by simply by using substitution of oh God, it's the other way around. I should have substituted this thing for I. It will be fixed in the final version of the slide. And now we can just cannibalize the semantic that I already gave rather than give all the semantic clauses again. So we simply interpret extended arithmetical expressions using the semantics for ordinary arithmetical semantics, for ordinary arithmetical expressions of the programming language, of the object programming language itself. Via this lifted interpretation functions. What we do with assertions themselves? Well, assertions are a bit glorified Boolean expressions of the programming language itself. And you remember, and again, I apologize for this crazy double notation, as you see now, it's more redouble, hopefully. We just send them into top and bottom, true and false. And I'm also using normal notation for operations on true and false. So, and actually, no, let's not even try to reuse the exact definition of semantics for Boolean expression gave before, because actually, introducing additional notation would be more of a mess than necessary. We can tell it directly as it is. So true is, well, true under in every state and under every interpretation. Again, I will most of the time write top instead of true. Equality is true if those extended arithmetical expressions that we know how to interpret are true, are equal, sorry, under this interpretation, this particular state, and false otherwise. Similarly, for inequality, Booleans in the obvious way, we know how negation is defined on the top and bottom. And we had this infinitary conjunction indexed by all integers, which could be alternatively indexed over all natural numbers. So of course this infinite conjunctions conjunction of assertions is true if all the conjuncts are true and false otherwise. Under a given interpretation, a given state. Now you remember that I also use those infinite conjunctions to interpret quantifiers, right? So I had let us recall again how it went. So I was interpreting for all I, or encoding for all I, the I whatever as conjunction over all that is Z, B with this I replaced by the constant naming. And using tiny, tiny little fact about interpretations of our Boolean expressions, namely, in any given state and for any given interpretation, interpreting the assertion where you replace the meta variable or logical variable with the constant naming the integer for the programming language itself produces the same thing as if you just interpreted the original assertion with the integer variable still living in there, but in such a way that interpretation function was updated to send the integer variable I to the integer Z. So you can push this linguistic, you can use interchangeably this linguistic substitution and metalinguistic or semantic substitution. It's clear what I'm saying here, right? It's again so trivial that reading it or writing it is more of an effort than understanding it, but this is the kind of boring little things that you always need to prove inductively. Now having this fact and having this interpretation for conjunction, infinitary conjunctions, and this definition for quantifiers, you can recall how quantifiers are normally interpreted in model theory in classes like GLOIN, where you have valuations of logical variables. Check if these two things are really the same. What does this defined, what do these defined quantifiers produce? So it should be something like interpretation of this guy should be true if the denotation of this thing in our state using all possible interpretations that are almost the same as the one that we start with, our I, with that one little difference that the non-capitalized, the small I is changed, can be sent to any integers that you want, holds. So this is the ordinary semantic clause for quantifiers. We could also make things look more logical or Tarskian style or forcing style by replacing the notation and saying that the denotation of our assertion in a given state and under given interpretation is true with the state sigma forces our assertion, makes true or satisfies or validates the assertion B under interpretation I. And in order to make things look even more and more like logic, we can say that assertion is universally valid if it's valid or satisfied in all possible states and under all possible interpretations. And what I'm heading for is, of course, and I hope that I will manage just to finish there, definition of satisfaction for whole triples at the bottom of this slide. The one ingredient that I'm missing now after introducing this convenient notation is what to do if the notation of our command C is turning our well-defined state C into non-termination bottom constant with this validating or forcing notation. And of course, the obvious convention, one of the obvious conventions, the most obvious of the two obvious conventions, and the only conventions that there are possible, is saying that the non-terminating thing or quasi-state or pseudo-state is making all possible assertions true. The other option would be, of course, to say that non-termination pseudo-state makes all the assertion false, which we could call total divergence conversion. So this is partial correctness assertion divergence conversion, and this is total, or total correctness assertion divergence conversion. We will return to it. Well, for now we have to forget about this whole thing. And now we can say what it means for Hoare triple to be valid in a given state under a given interpretation first, and then valid in general. So if I have a state and interpretation fixed, it has to be the case that whenever the precondition holds at a given state and a given interpretation, then what you obtain after execution of the command in a given state makes our assumption true. So it's just rewriting using our new definition of semantics of what we stated in plain words last time. Notice, now that I have this, it can be the case that this thing is non-terminating. So it means that in non-terminating situation, you can write any postcondition whatsoever under this convention. And then you say that a Hoare triple is valid if you can quantify the state and the interpretation away. Is it clear? We spent quite a lot of time, and went quite a long road to just formalize common sense, kind of, it would seem. I hope to capitalize on this, but of course now we are at overtime, so this has to happen next week. I will leave you with this to digest.